I'm a great fan of Calvin and Hobbes. Calvin and Hobbes. I wonder if you've seen the popular cartoon strip about the little boy and his tiger. The brilliance of Calvin and Hobbes is the way that the cartoonist switches back and forth between Calvin's view of the world, where the tiger Hobbes is alive and amusing and involved in everything that he does, and the real world, where Hobbes is just a stuffed toy. So you've got one moment, it's from Calvin's point of view, and the next it's from, as it were, everyone else's. And that, I suspect, is how believers are seen in our society. That's probably what your neighbours think of you if you're a Christian. It may even be what you yourself think. When I'm on my own or when I'm with Christians, Jesus is alive and important, but to everyone else, he's just lifeless. Is it a game? Rather childless game, childish game for adults to be playing. How should we answer such a challenge? Is there an answer? And why does it matter so much? Why does it matter whether Jesus rose from the dead? Well, for one thing, if Jesus really rose, that blows away the reigning secular worldview. If Easter is true, then there is a God who does things in our world, a God who has spoken. We are not alone. For a second thing, if Jesus really rose, it answers the great question, the big question in our pluralist society. It answers the question you're not even allowed to ask or acknowledge, how to choose between so many religions and worldviews. Well, imagine if you had to choose one out of a dozen surgeons to perform an operation to save your life. How would you choose? If I gave you this clue that 11 of them were dead, you'd go for the living one. Uniquely, Christians claim to follow a leader who conquered death. This makes the Christian faith different, makes it unique. No one would deny that Moses is dead. Or Muhammad, or Buddha, Darwin, Karl Marx. If Jesus rose, then he's set apart. He's in a league of his own. And for a third thing, if Jesus really rose, then that holds out hope regarding our biggest enemy, death. Death has dominated the news this past year, hasn't it? It continues to do so. Every week we have these death statistics. This week it was 3 million deaths to COVID worldwide. Death. Death casts a shadow across all of life. It threatens to make life meaningless. But the resurrection holds out hope. If Jesus stayed in the grave, then the Bible is dishonest, preaching is pointless, faith is pointless, and there is no answer to death or guilt. If Jesus stayed in the grave, then life is just as pointless as consistent atheists affirm and naive atheists deny. But if he rose, you see why it matters, why it's so important. But how could it be true? There must be another explanation. And indeed, there is close at hand in the verses that we read there in verse 13. His disciples came by night and stole him away while we were asleep. You know, maybe that's what happened. Of course, Matthew describes it as something that was made up, but he would say that, wouldn't he? So this morning, I want to talk about evidence for the resurrection of Jesus. I'm not going to talk about all the evidence. There's plenty more. But the evidence arising from these verses that we read in Matthew's gospel. But before we get to these verses here in Matthew's gospel, I want to start by talking about the limitations of evidence, the limitations of evidence. Now, I don't mean at all that the evidence for Jesus's resurrection is limited, but evidence in general has its limitations when it comes to persuading people. In fact, that's one of the absolutely vital lessons that we learn from these verses in Matthew. Look at verse 11. While they were going, behold, some of the guard went into the city and told the chief priests all that had taken place. While they were going, it's a striking contrast, isn't it? There are these two groups of people hurrying away from the same empty tomb with a message to deliver. In fact, they've got the same news, but with a very different impact and implication. For the women, hope, victory. For the guards, confusion and failure. The very thing that the women never imagined had happened. The very thing that the guards were posted to prevent had taken place. And Matthew wants us to see what happens next. You see how he puts it there. While they were going, behold, draws his attention to it. Behold, see, take note of this. See this new development. So here are the chief priests and elders. Doubtless they've been crowing over their victory, congratulating themselves that they finally got rid of Jesus. And suddenly they're confronted with this shocking news. God went into the city and told the chief priests all that had taken place, everything that had happened, the great earthquake, the angel of the Lord descending from heaven and sitting, rolling back the stone, appearance like lightning, the clothing white as snow. These things that made the guards tremble and become like dead men. So how do the religious leaders respond to this account of a supernatural event and a heavenly messenger? How do they respond? When they had assembled with the elders and taken counsel, they gave a sufficient sum of money to the soldiers and said, tell people his disciples came by night and stole him away while we were asleep. You would think that this at least would give them pause for thought. This amazing event that has taken place at the tomb. You'd think that at last they would think, well, maybe we were wrong to oppose Jesus. But no, they swing into damage limitation mode. This sordid attempt to try and save face. Remember how they taunted Jesus at the cross. They said, he saved others. He cannot save himself. He's the King of Israel. Let him come down now from the cross and we will believe in him. Come down and we'll believe in you. And now they have every reason to believe that Jesus has risen. But they still don't change their minds. If they're to stand by their crucifixion, they must deny his resurrection. And that is a striking example of the limitations of evidence. The chief priests and elders had too much to lose. Too much to lose to believe in the resurrection. And that can still be true today. Or take the guards. They actually felt the earthquake. They actually saw the angel descend in fearful brightness. Now there's evidence, if you like. So what did they do? Verse 15. They took the money and did as they were directed. They still spread the lie, despite what they'd experienced. Why? Well, because of what they stood to gain by embracing this alternative story. A large sum, sufficient, enough to buy off their consciences, enough to salve their reputations, enough to cloud their memories. If they'd have been Roman soldiers, no amount from the elders would have been enough, because it was an executable offence to fail on duty. A prisoner escapes and your life is forfeit. But it seems likely that these were part of the Jewish temple guard. That's why they report to the elders. That's why the governor just might not hear about it. But if he did, he could be bought off. If this comes to the governor's ears, we will satisfy him and keep you out of trouble. And so the guards leave with silver in their pockets and a story to tell. The elders had too much to lose to believe in the resurrection. And the guards had too much to gain by suppressing the evidence. And then see how this little episode ends. This story has been spread among the Jews to this day. The Jerusalem-based propaganda campaign was very successful. Matthew was writing about it, he says, doesn't he? He says, to this day, Matthew was writing about it decades after the events, but the story was still doing the rounds. And it was still being used in the second century. Justin Martyr, the Christian apologist, mentions it. And still it gets an airing sometimes today. And many Jews, now many Jews were convinced by the evidence. Many Jews were convinced that Jesus had risen from the dead. But many were not, even those who lived within walking distance of the now vacated tomb. Why not? Perhaps because it was easier that way. To really accept the resurrection of Jesus means a total upheaval in your thinking. And that was as true back then as it is now. Everything had to be rethought in the light of this remarkable event. It's far easier not to believe. One of my favorite quotes comes from the US investor, Warren Buffett. How do you say his name? No. Warren, the Berkshire Hathaway investor, one of the richest men on earth. And he has this quote. He says this: what the human being does best is interpreting all new information so that their prior conclusions remain intact. Human beings do best. They interpret all new information so that their prior conclusions remain intact. Whatever comes in, you sort of fit it round, you shape it in, you push it back so that nothing has to change in your thinking. That's not a new phenomenon. So you see the limitations of evidence. The elders and the chief priest, with the guards, with many of the wider populace. If you think that human beings in general are fearless pursuers of truth wherever it takes them, well, that's touching. But it's naive. By and large, we occupy our echo chambers, preferring to have our existing views reinforced rather than challenged. Limitations of evidence. Let me just linger and apply that. Maybe there's someone here, or maybe there's someone who's listening in, and you're skeptical about the facts of Christianity. Are you sure you're as objective as you like to think? Might it be that there's too much to lose if you really did believe in a risen Jesus? Might you actually gain in some ways from sticking with some alternative story? Isn't it just easier to avoid, not to face the repercussions of going where the evidence leads? But I know, I'm guessing that most of us do believe that Jesus rose again. And Matthew's spotlight on the limitations of evidence is a great help. Don't be surprised or discouraged or unsettled that most people in our culture don't share your belief. Doesn't mean the evidence is weak. Doesn't mean your presentation is flawed. Just reminds us of what a barrier there may be to embracing this fact and its implications. It's like the evidence of design and complexity in our world. As we look around, the complexity of the world, the fact that complex things don't come from simple things, that things don't come from nowhere by accident, and yet points to a great mind behind it, and people won't see it. It's too much to lose. Much easier. It's too much to gain by sticking to the acceptable story. So evidence will not convince anyone unless and until God empowers them to respond. So our most persuasive words must always be backed up with our most urgent prayers. But let's come back to our text, and in particular, the alternative story. His disciples came by night and stole him away while we were asleep. What can we say about that alternative story? Perhaps that's what did happen. It explains the empty tomb. Surely it's more plausible than a resurrection, at least to modern ears. Well, let's cross-examine our witnesses. If you were all asleep, how do you know what happened? His disciples came by night and stole him away while we were asleep. If you were asleep, how do you know what happened? How do you know it was the disciples who took it? How do you know Jesus didn't actually rise? Maybe one of us woke up. Then why didn't he sound the alarm and prevent the deed? Why didn't he pursue the body snatchers? And all of you were asleep on guard duty at the tomb. Really? When we actually probe the story, it's fairly obvious what it is. It's a quickly made up cover up that isn't even internally consistent. As the old writer Matthew Henry quaintly puts it, this was so thin a lie as one might easily see through. So thin a lie. And the remarkable thing is that all the alternative explanations for the Easter event unravel in just the same way. This is certainly not the only explanation which is given for the resurrection of Jesus, but all of them unravel in the same way. For 20 centuries, the cleverest minds have been seeking an alternative explanation for Easter, and the one given here is still one of the best. Despite its obvious flaws, this is still a contender. 20 centuries of imagination and creativity and desperately wanting to find an alternative, and the one that was made up on the spot the same day is still one of the best. Actually, the story is very revealing. So let's think with our historical investigation hats on what the story really tells us. For one thing, Matthew wouldn't have made it up. Why give skeptics something to run with? The only reason Matthew would include this account is precisely what he says in verse 15. This story has been spread among the Jews to this day. This story was doing the round, and that's why Matthew includes it here in his gospel. This story genuinely was circulated. What does that tell us? Well, it confirms to us the basic outline of the events. It confirms to us that Jesus was crucified and that his dead body was placed in a tomb. It confirms that friends and foes alike knew the location of the tomb. And it tells us that the tomb was guarded. Now, immediately, this rules out various other tall tales. It rules out the idea that there was a mistake. It rules out the idea that the women went to the wrong tomb. No, Jesus' body was in a guarded tomb. And it also tells us that something happened that left the tomb empty. So the fact that this story was circulated shows that there was an empty tomb that needed explaining. Otherwise, there wouldn't be any need for this story. And this knocks on the head the idea that the followers of Jesus, you know, some people say the followers of Jesus just wanted so much for him to be alive that they came to believe that he was. And the whole hallucinations thing. If that was the case, the authorities would just bring out the body. Here we are, folks. Here is Jesus. There were plenty of people who wanted to nip it all in the bud, but they couldn't because the tomb was empty. This whole story of the guards presupposes and confirms that. And this story tells us something else too. It tells us that everyone in the ancient world knew what resurrection meant. You know, a more recent, perhaps the most popular alternative story at the moment is the idea that all this New Testament language about Jesus's resurrection is simply picture language. You know, Jesus lives on in his teaching. I remember David Cameron, when he was prime minister, making some Easter speech and talking about the life, death and living legacy of the Lord Jesus. Let's see what he's done there. It's not that Jesus lives, just his legacy lives. Jesus lives on in his teaching. He's still here with us, here. But then why bother with a guard? Why bother with a cover-up story? No, resurrection meant what it sounds like, a previously dead body being alive again. And you see the point. This alternative story unwittingly rules out all sorts of other alternative stories. The fact that this story was spread actually tells us a great deal. In fact, it perfectly fits Matthew's account of the resurrection. Let's think of some further evidence. If Jesus really did rise, then this is exactly the response we would expect from the religious leaders. And it makes sense that the guards would tell a story like this if they were paid enough. But it makes no sense that Christians would tell the story of Jesus' resurrection if they'd actually stolen the body. If Christians had stolen the body, they wouldn't tell a story of the resurrection. For one thing, as one writer puts it was 3 centuries before anyone gained anything except insults, danger, torture, and death by believing in the resurrection. You might say yes, maybe in an act of bravery, they stole the body in order to give it a decent burial and then continue on. But you wouldn't make up a story of a resurrection and all the grief and all the trouble that it brought. And this movement, there was no pocket full of silver for Christians. There was no one to keep them out of official trouble. And this movement, supposedly founded on such a base deception, was characterized by integrity and truthfulness. Everyone agrees that. A theft of Jesus' body is utterly incompatible with what they subsequently were as heroes and martyrs. It just doesn't make any sense. And why would anyone make up a story where women were the first key eyewitnesses? If you were going to invent a story, that's the last thing you'd do. Why? Because in those unenlightened days, a woman's testimony wasn't valid in a court of law. So here's what Josephus writes, a contemporary historian, Jewish historian. He says, from women, let no evidence be accepted because of the levity and temerity of their sex. Now, we might be rightly indignant, but that was the culture. So when Paul describes the heart of the Christian faith, he lists a whole string of eyewitnesses. But there are no women in his list, because he wanted it to be as persuasive as possible in a suspicious and mocking world. But Matthew includes women. Why? Because that's what happened. It's the same sort of honesty that came through in verse 17, where we said Jesus appeared, some doubted. That's not the sort of thing you add to make your story sound more plausible. Or the fact that the guards were only posted the next day after the burial. You don't put things in like that unless they're true. Just doesn't make sense that the first followers of Jesus would invent a story with these details. It'd be like inventing the story in our day and having two politicians arriving at the tomb to discover that it was empty. In the current climate of suspicion and cynicism, that would hardly make it as convincing as possible, would it? Who should we have? Or maybe we could have bankers. This is not the story that you would make up. Does it make sense that the first followers of Jesus would invent a story with these details? But it does make sense that the people who had crucified Jesus would be desperate to avoid any suggestion that he had risen again. So all the evidence, and there's plenty more, all the evidence points to the fact that Jesus did rise again. However bizarre, however impossible or implausible that might sound at first sight. Here's how one writer puts it. The birth and rapid rise of the Christian church remain an unsolved enigma for any historian who refuses to take seriously the one explanation offered by the church itself. It's an unsolved enigma, unless you actually take seriously what the church said happened. That makes sense of it all. And so we see then the evidence for the resurrection of Jesus Christ. You've seen what Matthew shows us without looking at Mark, without looking at Luke and John, without looking at the New Testament, without thinking about the church itself, where it came from, and things that were very specific and unusual about it, which can only be explained by a risen Jesus. The evidence for the resurrection of Jesus Christ is compelling. But are you compelled? Are you persuaded? And if you are, has it affected more than your mind? You know, it's possible to believe something without it actually making any difference. If Jesus is risen, then Jesus is Lord. If Jesus is risen, then everything is different. Everything should be different. But is it? Do you live any differently from those who scoff at the idea of a resurrection? In terms of your money, in terms of your time, in terms of your hopes, in terms of your fears, in terms of your words, in terms of your actions, in terms of your priorities, are you different? Everything should be different in the light of this great event. May God enable us to live as people of the risen King. Let's finish with that song. we think about it together. Come, people of the risen King, who delights to bring him praise. What are the implications? What should it